Sweden went its own way to contain the coronavirus. Some people called it rogue, others said it was reckless. So how's Sweden now?
This will be going on for a long time. And I think we should wait at least a year before we draw any conclusions which strategy worked and which did not.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the defiant Russian opposition leader, Vladimir Kara-Murza.
It would be too much of a gift to the Kremlin if we all just gave up and ran. This is what they want us to do. Well, we're not going to do it.
And the UN General Assembly is underway in New York, a virtual meeting this year. We take a nostalgic look back at the theatrics when the world's leaders are in one room together.
Yesterday, the devil came here, and it smells of sulfur still today.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could join us today. This is usually the time of year we talk about gridlock in New York City with the UN General Assembly in session. Not this year. The UNGA is virtual, online only. And it's a big one, the 75th session of the General Assembly. What has not changed is what it means, a chance for world leaders to stand in front of a global audience to speak their minds and even get a bit theatrical. Today's virtual lineup includes President Trump, along with the presidents of Brazil, China, Turkey, Russia, and Iran, to name a few. The theme? The future we want, reaffirming our collective commitment to multilateralism. That was not the tone President Trump took when he used part of his time today to talk about the coronavirus.
We must hold accountable the nation which unleashed this plague onto the world, China. In the earliest days of the virus, China locked down travel domestically while allowing flights to leave China and infect the world.
Michael Green has been watching the speeches closely today. He's a former National Security Council senior director for Asia. I asked him what he made of Trump's criticism of China.
Today's speech struck me as intended to resonate with his political base at home, especially Fox News and the echo chamber for his presidential campaign. Pitched in exactly the wrong way for countries in Western Europe, Japan, Korea, Australia, India want to work with the U.S. on the China problem. They don't trust China, but they don't like the unilateral approach that the Trump administration has taken. And today's speech pretty much doubled down on that unilateral approach.
You were an advisor to former President George W. Bush. In terms of just looking at China and how other U.S. presidents have dealt with China, especially in election year, do you see much difference?
Where I think the Trump administration deserves some credit is they're the first administration since really the 1970s to say that China is a strategic competitor. And the American people, the Congress on a bipartisan basis, the Biden campaign, most of our close allies agree with that. Now the question is, how do we work together to curtail China's most egregious behaviors, whether it's in Hong Kong or Xinjiang or on trade? And the answer is by working together. And unfortunately, the speech at the UNGA was not about working together. It was really about blaming China in a way that, you know, even Japan or India that have fierce competition with China are not willing to sign up for.
When you were senior director for national security under President George W. Bush, did you write the kind of speeches that he'd end up delivering at the UNGA?
Yeah, we worked on them. But even a speech like this one for the UNGA, every part of the NSC that's got a stake in it would have the pen. So I'm sure the people who do Asia policy for President Trump helped craft some of that language. And in their own comments out and about, they are pushing a very hard line. They are essentially suggesting that the Chinese Communist Party is irredeemable, you know, almost like the Soviet Union. This only ends when that Chinese Communist Party is gone. That is a very stark difference from every previous administration. It's not entirely wrong, but it's not a policy that even our closest allies will sign on for. Nobody, not the Japanese, not the Taiwanese, the Indians, nobody is signing on for a policy of regime change, of containing China until the Chinese Communist Party collapses. There's just too much intertwined trade and too many interests in working with China, even as people fear China.
How much does that worry you?
Chinese media is actually propagating the idea that President Trump is so overblown right now, he might create a war in the Taiwan Strait with China to save his election. That's Global Times and the somewhat more nationalistic media. But it's been stunning to me how many Chinese scholars who I talk to who are pretty level-headed actually think it might be true that President Trump might actually want a war to save his election. And that has to be dangerous. And so it worries me a bit. The other thing that worries me is that the Chinese leadership – does not have a good pulse, finger for the pulse on the American leadership. We don't have a strategic dialogue. You know, President Bush was able to talk to his counterparts about any issue. Condoleezza Rice could travel to China. I went with her and sit down one-on-one with the Chinese leaders and convey President Bush's, you know, hopes and his concerns and his tough messages. Obama had that with Hillary Clinton and the Chinese state counselor. We've always had these channels. We don't have them right now. It's not clear to the Chinese who speaks for President Trump on any given day. And it's very obvious that the Trump administration has very little communication channel to Beijing. That lack of a crisis management dialogue channel could get us in big trouble if we have an accident right now. And the rhetoric in today's speech certainly doesn't make it easier to establish that kind of channel.
Michael Green is a former National Security Council Senior Director for Asia. He's now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Michael, good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I mentioned earlier some of the past theatrics at the UN General Assembly when there is not a pandemic and leaders are face to face. The iconic chamber in New York has been the site of some flamboyant speeches over the years. The world's Jason Margolis takes us down memory lane.
Nothing beats the UN General Assembly in 1960. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev took off his shoe, waved it in the air, then banged it against the table to interrupt a speech. At least, that's how the story goes. Historians are still debating whether Khrushchev actually banged his loafer or just waved it in the air. This was 1960, so there's no footage of the event to confirm the details. Fast forward to another theatrical moment in 2006. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez had some choice words for the American president, George W. Bush.
Yesterday, the devil came here. Right here.
En este mismo lugar,
right here.
Huele a azufre todavía.
And it smells of sulfur still today.
By the rules, speakers are limited to 15 minutes, but there's no orchestra to play them off if they run long. 11 years ago, Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi spoke for more than 90 minutes. He ripped into the international body, at one point taking out a copy of the Charter of the United Nations, reading from it.
No, we are not equals. And the preamble says that all nations are equal.
Then, from the podium, ripping it up. He also tossed a piece of paper at Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Gaddafi's 90-minute speech, though, was nothing compared to Fidel Castro's performance in 1960. The Cuban leader held the floor for 4.5 hours. Then there are the props. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has done this trick a couple of times, including in 2012.
Brought a diagram for you.
He showed a drawing of a cartoonish bomb that looked like a cannonball with a fuse. The image was divided into sections representing Iran's progress towards enriching enough uranium for a bomb.
Where should a red line be drawn? A red line should be drawn right here.
Another attention-grabbing tactic during UN speeches, the walkout. In 2011, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad railed against the United States and other Western nations.
Who used the mysterious September 11th incident as a pretext to attack Afghanistan and Iraq, killing, injuring. And
dozens of diplomats in the assembly hall weren't having it. They got up out of their seats and left. This year, with a pandemic, of course, there can be no walkouts with a virtual assembly. Maybe just diplomats putting someone else on mute. For the world, I'm Jason Margolis.
Sweden has been the country that a lot of people have loved to hate during the pandemic. Its no-lockdown strategy was seen as naive and cruel by some, but the World Health Organization has praised Sweden's results. A few weeks ago, Sweden did massive testing and found a record low infection rate. But now rates are creeping up, and Stockholm is considering further measures to contain the virus. Dr. Johan Giesecke is a Swedish physician and professor at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. I asked him if he was concerned about the rise in coronavirus cases.
I don't think we should look at it at all. It may be a statistical fluctuation. It's going up and down. It was up a couple of a month ago and then down again. So I think we should wait to make any judgment on that.
But, I mean, you are seeing an increase, no?
Yeah, there is an increase, and people are concerned about it, yes.
So if cases continue to rise in Sweden, at what point would you advise Sweden to strengthen its measures? Like, what kind of increase would you need to see before pushing for that?
I couldn't say, but it's not the time yet anyway.
You know that Sweden has come in for some really tough criticism for its no-lockdown policy. It's something that Swedish officials and professionals have been saying the rest of the world just doesn't understand. Help us understand the situation in Sweden.
Well, we've had a lockdown. I call it a soft lockdown, and it builds on voluntary participation by the people. But if you tell people how this disease transmits and what's the things you should avoid, people will listen to you. People are not stupid.
You talked about a soft lockdown. Explain what that actually is.
It is, for example, as soon as you feel the slightest cold, you should stay at home and not go to work. Work at home as much as you can. Avoid crowded places. There are a few legal restrictions. A crowd can't be bigger than 50 people, for example. And bus drivers are allowed to deny entrance in their buses if there are too many people in there. So there are a few, but mostly it builds on voluntary participation.
When it comes to the practical advice for the Swedish population, is the government urging people to maintain social distancing, wear masks?
Not wear masks.
Not wear masks?
No.
Why has that not been one of the things that the government's pushing for?
Because there's no science to prove that they work.
And yet we hear from experts all over the world that there are plenty of reasons, and scientific ones, to wear masks.
Yep, but that's the way it's seen here.
Sweden has reported nearly 5,900 deaths since the start of the pandemic. That's more per capita than both Denmark and Norway. So at this point of the pandemic, what do you think explains the difference?
I think Sweden had a much bigger seeding of cases in late February and early March than our neighbor countries had. We started at a much higher number of infected people than they did.
Dr. Giesecke, you played a key role in coming up with Sweden's response to the coronavirus. What do you know now that you didn't know 6 months ago about the best way to contain this virus?
It spreads more in clusters than influenza does. Influenza moves like a wave over the population, but this disease jumps from group of people to new group of people, and that wasn't clear 6 months ago. And that makes, for example, contact tracing becomes much more important with a cluster disease like COVID.
And how has it reoriented your approach to containing the coronavirus in Sweden?
Contact tracing is now very important. It's done rigorously in all parts of the country, following up contacts, testing them. So that has become more important now than it would have been during a flu season.
So if you believe, and it sounds like you do firmly, that the Swedish approach is largely working, how come other countries have not adopted it, especially other Nordic countries?
The problem was much smaller in their country when it all started. And there are political reasons as well, but I won't go into that. There's one thing I would say, that it's far too early to compare countries to countries now. We're at the beginning of this. This will be going on for a long time. And I think we should wait at least a year before we draw any conclusions of which strategy worked and which did not.
Looking back right now in September of 2020, is there anything that Sweden should have done differently at the start of the pandemic?
We should have been better at protecting the old and the frail. That was the mainstay of the strategy, but it didn't really work, actually, for a number of reasons.
And why not?
We weren't really prepared, I would say.
But wasn't that kind of like one of the first headlines about the coronavirus, that it's, you know, people with comorbidities and the elderly who will be most affected?
Yes, but it takes some time to get all the equipment and the training, and you don't do that from one day to the next. So we were late, I think, there.
What about Swedes? What's been kind of the Swedish attitude about this approach to containing the coronavirus? Has anybody protested?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There have been quite a number of people who say that this is wrong. But this is a democracy. People are allowed to have their own views, but maybe less than in other countries. And we have not had the U.S. reaction that this is against the Constitution. That reaction hasn't been here at all.
Johan Giesecke is a Swedish physician and professor at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. He's also an advisor to the WHO on the pandemic. Dr. Giesecke, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You don't need a reminder that the presidential election is just weeks away. The impact of who Americans elect reaches far beyond the United States. Coming up, what's at stake for global climate change in the U.S. presidential election? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Only a small percentage of the globe's population will elect the next American president, but the election results will have a huge impact on the globe's population. Over the next several weeks, we'll be looking at some of the ways that plays out. Today, how the next U.S. president will impact climate change. It's something activists, academics, and diplomats are all thinking about a lot.
It's the most important election, I think, in almost the history of climate crisis.
Certainly, it is a very, very important moment.
Around the family breakfast table, it's a constant source of discussion.
We have a saying that if the U.S. sneezes, the Caribbean catches the cold. So definitely, we've been paying very close attention.
So has the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler, who spoke with those people for this story about the stakes for the planet in November's election.
Wildfires are burning, hurricanes are plaguing the Caribbean, and the Arctic is seeing some of its lowest ice cover ever. Ahead of the 2020 election, the climate world is focused on the fate of the best diplomatic tool it has to keep climate change in check, the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Take it from former Trinidadian climate negotiator Ruana Haynes.
This election is really going to be very, very critical for whether or not we're actually able to meet the Paris Agreement goals and secure the future of the vulnerable around the world.
The Paris Agreement was the first universal binding pact to fight climate change. In it, almost every country in the world agreed to keep the increase in the globe's average temperature to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Back in 2017, President Donald Trump announced he was pulling the U.S. out of it.
As of today, the United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden says he'll get the U.S. right back in if he's elected.
I'll put us back in the business of leading the world on climate change. And I'll challenge every other country to up the ante on climate commitments.
Here's why upping the ante matters for keeping global warming in check. In the Paris Pact, governments agreed to set targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But those targets, they're not legally binding. And so far, they're not nearly ambitious enough. The whole idea is for countries to name those targets, then pressure each other to meet and eventually increase them. Here's how Håkon Salin, a senior researcher at the Center for International Climate Research, puts it.
Countries would start doing a little, and they would see that others are doing a little, and then they would gradually be willing to do more and also build up trust.
Salin gamed out what the U.S. staying out of the agreement might mean long term. His computer models suggest it would lower other countries' trust and their willingness to reduce their own emissions.
One thing we find is that over time, the effect on other countries' emissions is actually even larger than the direct effect on U.S. emissions.
We're already feeling the impact of the pollutants we've pumped into the air since the Industrial Revolution. Worse heat waves and wildfire seasons, more intense hurricanes, rising sea levels that make storm surges more damaging. Ruana Haynes, the Trinidadian diplomat, who's also an advisor to the Alliance of Small Island States, says these impacts pose an existential threat to the world's most vulnerable people.
The impacts in the Caribbean region specifically are already quite extreme.
She points, as an example, to Hurricane Dorian. It was a Category 5 hurricane that intensified rapidly last year and pounded the Bahamas for a day and a half.
And that hurricane was actually completely unprecedented and absolutely unpredictable. And that's the type of increased activity that we're seeing. And so the outlook is a very, very challenging one.
The next election, of course, dictates who controls U.S. environmental policy for just 4 years. But Bill Hare, a climate scientist and CEO of Climate Analytics, says those 4 years could actually make a real difference.
In the next decade, we'd have to more than halve present emissions to be on a climate-safe pathway. So that can tell you straight away that the next decade of action are critical. And if we don't achieve significant reductions in the next 4 or 5 years, it's going to make the task extremely expensive, if not technologically prohibitive.
President Trump has spent the last 4 years rolling back what he calls job-killing regulations. That includes rules that would have limited greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, increased auto emission standards, and required oil and gas companies to limit methane leaks. But on the global stage, the U.S. represents more than just the world's second biggest carbon footprint.
The U.S. plays a critical role in the global economy. It's also a key source of technological innovation. And diplomatically, if the U.S. stays out of the global efforts to ramp up action, then I think a lot of countries will hide behind the U.S.
Hare points to coal-reliant Poland, Jair Bolsonaro's pro-development Brazil, and a so-called gas-powered economic recovery in his native Australia as examples of where action on climate change may wane without U.S. pressure. President Trump's list of second-term priorities does not include anything about climate change. Just last week, in an exchange with California's Secretary for Natural Resources Wade Crowfoot, President Trump again expressed skepticism about established climate science.
It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
Biden, on the other hand, is framing a vote for him as a vote to reestablish the U.S. as a global leader on climate change. He says he'll push for an end to global fossil fuel subsidies and pressure China to lower the carbon footprint of its development initiatives. Progressive activists want Biden to be more aggressive, for example, by banning fracking. But they largely see him as a moderate they can work with. Eyal Weintraub is a youth climate organizer in Argentina.
I think that a Biden election plus a huge mass movement which forces him to take action, I think that could be significant in really starting to make faster the transition to green energy.
Weintraub is part of a generation of activists inspired by Swedish teen Greta Thunberg, who see themselves as part of a climate movement that crosses borders. So even though Weintraub can't vote in the U.S., he says he'll be watching on election night.
If you're a climate activist, you need to have your eyes on the television that night. I'm going to be watching it for sure.
Probably, he says, with a few beers and some friends. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And a note to add here. Today, in his address to the United Nations, President Xi Jinping announced a new climate target for China. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
We will reach the peaking of CO2 emission before 2030 and reach carbon neutrality before 2060.
Carbon neutrality by 2060 for the world's biggest emitter is big news, and it sends a signal. China is moving forward with its international commitments, even as the U.S. has said it won't. We've been hearing how there's a lot at stake for the global environment in the U.S. election, now just weeks away. But for months, the world has been bringing you the voices and important context to help make sense of a country facing a critical choice. Explore more of our 2020 election coverage. Just head over to theworld.org/2020election. You're with The World. A barber in Toronto is struggling. Banks won't give him a loan.
You apply and you don't get it. And this is what we experience in the black community also. I'm not the only one. I know a lot of other businesses that go through the same exact thing.
Now, Canada has a plan to fund black business owners, but some wonder if it will ever happen. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. In one way or another, for most kids around the globe, school is back in session this month. It's a huge adjustment, no matter where you are in school, attending class online or the hybrid model, partly online, partly in person. It is a lot. Now think about kids who are attending school online, but their school is located half a world away. The World's Rebecca Cantha reports from Shanghai.
Every night, Titi Bakum and her three daughters rush through dinner as the girls get ready to start their classes. That's because they go to school in Shanghai, China, but have been stuck in Iowa since February.
So in the evenings, instead of winding down, relaxing and contemplating the day, we are up and awake and alert and like, you know, this is the time we have to be most focused.
When COVID-19 shut down schools across China, Titi brought her kids to her home near Des Moines, thinking it would be better for them there. Now, 7 months later, they're still stuck there. School started September 1st, and that's meant new schedules for everyone. For 9-year-old Vivian, the youngest in the family, the adjustment has been extreme. She starts school at 7:30 p.m. and gets to bed after 1 a.m. most nights. She says she's gotten used to it, but staying up past her bedtime makes her hungry. She says she eats 3 dinners a night.
And also I get tired, so I probably don't remember stuff as well.
In the spring, all of Vivian's classmates in Shanghai were doing online schooling too. Now she's the only one. This is the sound of Vivian's classroom in Shanghai. The teachers put a phone in the front row so Vivian can watch the lessons. Her mom says it's a poor substitute for being inside the classroom.
The teacher's so focused on presenting their lesson that it's hard for them to pay attention to if Vivian has a problem or if she needs something because she's just a little phone on the desk.
Vivian's 15-year-old sister Maya is a morning person and is struggling with the late-night math class.
But it's math, so I was like, okay, you have to stay awake, you have to stay awake. And I did. I fell asleep like 10 minutes after that. I just closed my computer on the table, bed.
Maya's obviously doing her best to keep up. Still, the schedule seems to change every day.
It's like when you're going down the water slide, you can't see the end. You know, like the twisty ones where you can't see past the corner.
That's a really good description.
Yeah, we're learning metaphors.
Maya's classmate Annabelle Ye started her school year from rural North Carolina. She and her family were stuck there for more than half a year. They just got back to Shanghai last week. Annabelle says one of the hardest parts of going to school remotely was knowing all of her friends were back together in China. On the very first day of school, she watched her high school's assembly on a live stream.
Yeah, it's a really strange feeling. I feel like distance learning and mental health, it's like a fragile connection.
Annabelle's younger brother, Micah, just started 7th grade at a new school. He says those first-day jitters were magnified online.
Starting at a new school when it's overseas, so it's kind of strange. All of the people there knew each other beforehand because they'd all been there for like 6th grade or so. So when I got there, it was like everyone knew each other and I was like the only person who was new there.
But Micah saw some benefits to being so far from school.
PE classes, instead of just like doing normal classes, I can go hiking. The closest thing you can hike in Shanghai is a skyscraper.
Kids doing online schooling all over the world are learning an important lesson in resilience. Annabelle and Micah will go through a new transition next week as they attend school in person for the first time this year. Meanwhile, Titi and her kids are still trying to get visas and flights back to China. Titi says she keeps telling herself and her kids that this experience will make a great college admissions essay in a few years. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
A rigged election, a governor kidnapped and imprisoned, and a poisoned opposition leader. That's the kind of summer it's been in Russia and in Belarus. Out of all that, an eruption of protests. In Russia's Far East, they want their governor back. In Belarus, outrage over those rigged presidential elections in August I mentioned, they show no signs of letting up. And the poisoned politician Alexei Navalny, one of the leaders of Russia's opposition movement, is slowly recovering in a German hospital. Poisoning enemies, fraudulent elections, and protests. It's all too familiar for my next guest, Vladimir Karamurza. Like Navalny, he's also a prominent Russian opposition leader. He's vice president of the Free Russia Foundation. And also like Navalny, he too has been poisoned in what's thought to be politically motivated attacks. Vladimir Karamurza, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me back, Marcus. Good to be back on your program. And finally, some good news in a long time, as Alexei is now well on his way to recovery. Thank God.
Right. We've seen the images that Navalny is slowly recovering from that poisoning and seems to be looking better one day at a time. When you see those images, Vladimir, Navalny trying to restart his life, what comes to mind? How do you react?
Well, I must say that I've been living this sort of horrendous Groundhog Day for the last, more than a month now, since the news first came that he was poisoned after he collapsed on that plane from Tomsk to Moscow at the end of August. You know, I've had to live through this twice, and apart from everything else, it is a very painful and excruciating experience. When you can't breathe, when your organs fail one after another, when you just feel the life slowly coming out of your body. And so, yes, everything looks very familiar, unfortunately, but also, you know, in a good way, of course. I went both times I was poisoned. Doctors told my wife that I had about a 5% chance to live. I made it, and Alexei thankfully has made it. And I know it's going to be a long and difficult road to recovery ahead. I mean, I had to learn to walk again after the first poisoning. Your body really does give up really quickly once you're in a coma. So it's not going to be quick or easy, but it is possible. And he will get back. He will be back to good health. He will be back in Russia, and he will be back to his important work of standing up to the corruption and dictatorship of Vladimir Putin.
Is there any doubt in your mind that this poisoning was in fact directed by the Kremlin?
No, of course not. I mean, look, there's a long and growing list of political opposition leaders, independent journalists, anti-corruption campaigners and the like who have suffered this fate in the last two decades. I mean, this method actually goes back to Soviet times. You know, since Putin came to power 20 years ago, this method has really proliferated.
Right. Were you surprised to hear that Navalny intends to go back to Russia as soon as he can?
No, you know, what I was surprised about is the fact that it actually made news. I mean, I got quite a few phone calls from journalists the day that this was announced asking for my reaction. And I said, well, frankly, I don't understand what the news is here. Of course, he was always going to go back. He's a Russian politician. You can't be a politician and not be in the country. You know, I went back home to Russia as soon as I was literally able to walk after I recovered from the poisoning. I also did medical rehabilitation abroad, but I went back as soon as I could. Look, it would be too much of a gift to the Kremlin and to the Putin regime if we all just gave up and ran. This is what they want us to do. Well, we're not going to do it. You know, we care about our country. We care about the future of our country. We think our country deserves better than to live in a 21st century under a corrupt and authoritarian system.
I'm speaking with Russian opposition leader Vladimir Karamurza. Let me ask you about sanctions, because there have been talks of new German and EU sanctions against Russian officials in response to the Navalny poisoning and other political repression. You were in Germany, Vladimir, recently lobbying for new sanctions. What were you asking the Germans to do?
So one of the first questions that people in the European Union were asking, what should the reaction be? What should the response be? And, you know, my answer to that, and I know the answer for many of my colleagues and friends in the Russian opposition was the same, that, you know, it's mind-boggling that to this day there is still no Magnitsky Act in the European Union. You know, there is one in the United States. There has been now for the best part of a decade. Of course, the Magnitsky Act is a law that provides for targeted personal sanctions against foreign government officials, not just in Russia, but anywhere else, who are personally complicit in human rights abuses in their own countries and corruption in their own countries. Of course, the brilliance of this mechanism is that it is directed at individuals. You know, you're not sanctioning or punishing entire nations for the actions of a few crooks and criminals. And it is astonishing that to this day, there is no such mechanism in the European Union. Thankfully, that is now changing. 2 weeks ago, as you mentioned, I had the honor of joining members of the German Bundestag in Berlin for the announcement of the introduction of a German Magnitsky law or draft law into the German parliament. And just a few days ago, Ursula von der Leyen, who is the leader of the European Union, made a similar announcement during her annual State of the Union address.
This House has called many times for a European Magnitsky Act. And I can announce that we will now come forward with a proposal. We need to complete our toolbox.
This should be the main practical response. The political response, I think, is that there should be a very clear understanding that while Vladimir Putin remains in power, there should be no more talk of any kind of reset, detente, or business as usual, whatever you want to call it, with a political regime that speaks with its opponents in a language of poisons and bullets.
Let's talk about Belarus, Russia's neighbor to the West. Recently, an election took place that landed the president of 26 years back in power, the vote widely seen as fraudulent. The protest movement there has been going on for well over a month now. Have you been surprised by the sustained nature of these protests?
No, because, I mean, even though Belarusians are supposed to be one of the calmest, one of the most polite nations in Europe, even the most calm and the most polite people can get fed up with somebody who's been in power for 26 years. And so the feelings I do have are feelings of awe and admiration and respect for those amazingly courageous people of Belarus who continue to come out to protest in the face of unthinkable violence and repression, even by the standards of the Lukashenko regime. And of course, it rhymes very closely with what's been happening in the Russian Far East, in the city of Khabarovsk, which you mentioned in the introduction, where for even longer, actually, since the beginning of July, there have been and continue to be mass street protests directed against the Kremlin and against the Putin regime. And this is, by the way, only one of the first warning signs. You know, the reason Putin is so afraid of what's happening in Belarus is because for him, this is a glimpse into his own future. Putin and Lukashenko are the last two dictators in Europe. So what's happening on the streets of Belarus today is very likely to happen in Russia in 4 years' time, or less now, in 3.5 years' time. And this is why Putin's so incredibly frightened.
Your respect and awe for the Belarusian protests, Vladimir, what can Russians learn from the movement there? Have you learned any new lessons as you look to Belarus?
Well, I think what's most important is solidarity. I think it's very important for us as peoples, for civil societies, for democratic oppositions in Russia and Belarus to cooperate with each other and support each other, because if we look at the big historical picture, and I'm a historian by education, so 35 years ago, which by historical standards was yesterday, half of Europe was living under dictatorial, authoritarian or totalitarian regimes. Today, there are only two dictatorships left in Europe. Those are Russia and Belarus. But in my view, in the 21st century, even two dictatorships in Europe are too many. So it's important for us to work together in solidarity and cooperation to make sure that Europe is completely dictator-free in the foreseeable future. And I'm confident we can achieve that.
Vladimir Karamurza is one of Russia's most prominent opposition leaders. He's vice president of the Free Russia Foundation. Vladimir, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Marco. Always good to be on your program.
At least we have the internet. Can you imagine getting through a pandemic with zero social connections aside from your household or the friends and neighbors on your block? For İskan Ordaz, there is a silver lining to starting college in 2020.
I really do feel a sense of connection, so I don't feel much lonelier than I would.
Ordaz is also spending a lot more time with his parents in Texas. He's learning more about his dad's experience emigrating from Mexico as a teen and how his parents are feeling during this election year. That's been shaping the views of this college freshman. For our series Every 30 Seconds, we've been hearing from first-time voters like Ordaz. We named the series Every 30 Seconds because every 30 seconds, a young Latino turns 18 in the U.S. and becomes eligible to vote. Reporter Stella Chavez from KERA in Dallas takes us to the home of İskan Ordaz in Fort Worth, Texas.
So, made this to Ben's.
In the Ordaz family backyard, there's a lush garden with more than two dozen vegetables, herbs, and flowers.
So these are zinnias. It's a Mexican flower, and they're just a flower machine.
Simon Ordaz, İskan's dad, shows them off.
We had some carrots, just some potatoes. These are lemongrass, some elephant ears.
This garden, it's his labor of love, he says. His wife, Xochitl Ortiz, points to the trees in the garden, a reminder of her visits to Mexico.
Both of my grandmas had a lime tree. None of them had the pomegranate tree, but those are two things that just, I have that, I guess, connection, that memory.
For both parents, the garden doesn't let them forget their cultural roots. It's especially important for Ordaz, who grew up in a town in Mexico where everyone knew how to work the fields.
I think it was at age 9, you know, all my my classmates, they would finish school and then they went to work on the field, helping out. So everyone knew how to use, you know, a shovel and how to do all this physical work.
Naturally, Ordaz taught his son İskan how to use a shovel and pickaxe, and he says how to sweat. That outdoor work can sometimes be a rude awakening for 18-year-old İskan.
I come outside, he's got like all this dirt. I'm like, why is there all this dirt on the sidewalk? And then he's like, oh yeah, that's for us. I'm like, oh. I mean, it took us hours, like all these trips to unload all this dirt.
All joking aside, these moments in the garden are also an opportunity for father and son to bond. It's a bond that's rooted in İskan's deep admiration for his dad, who faced a number of challenges, like not knowing English, when he arrived in the U.S. He was 16, just a couple of years younger than İskan.
I'm this age, right, coming to a new country. I don't know English. I'm like, how could I do that? You know, it was just always so hard for me to imagine that for myself.
İskan is part of a new generation of voters who were born in the U.S., but whose parents or grandparents came from other countries. Their immigration stories and experiences are passed down. İskan says hearing his dad's story is humbling and sometimes shapes his views.
It was always something to keep me in check, to get me back to the books. If I saw myself slipping up or, you know, going on my phone, then I would have to, like, think back, and it was something that would motivate me. You know, get me up out of bed, I don't want to get up. I'm like, hey, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, look what he did.
İskan's dad was part of a wave of economic migrants who came to the U.S. in the early 90s. Growing up in Mexico, the elder Ordaz says his biggest dream was to study and become a working professional. But he couldn't afford to pay for college, so Ordaz decided to move to the U.S.
I saw my dad coming from humble beginnings or whatever. He was a very smart person, but he wasn't able to find a lot of opportunities because he, you know, did not have an education.
Ordaz worked as a busboy in restaurants and bars in the Chicago area. He'd finish his shift at 1 or 2 a.m., then wake up at 6 to catch a bus to go to high school.
My shifts were, you know, 14, 16 hours a day. And
Sorry.
Ordaz takes a long pause before finishing the sentence. It was hard, he says. In his first apartment, he lived with more than a dozen other men, all single and also from Mexico. Eventually, Ordaz made it to college and studied electrical engineering. Iscan heard these stories growing up. Sitting across the kitchen table from his dad, Iscan reflects.
There's a picture that I remember like seeing when I was little. We had it out at the old house, and it was like it was like right at the top of the stairs. But it was like you took me to the zoo, and your eyes were all red. And I didn't realize it when I was young, but until I got like older, and that's when I realized that like you did it all for us.
And Iscan says he'll hold on to those life lessons, especially now as he navigates college life during a pandemic with so much uncertainty ahead. For The World, I'm Stella Chavez in Fort Worth, Texas.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently announced funding to support Black entrepreneurs in his country. It's part economic recovery plan and also a way of dismantling systemic racism. The Canadian government is teaming up with financial institutions to make it easier for Black business owners to get financing and training. But as Anita Elash in Toronto reports, some entrepreneurs are giving the plan mixed reviews.
With its reggae music and retro decor, the Supernatural Hair Salon and Spa in Toronto's East End has been a busy community barbershop for more than a decade. But these days, the owner, Kurt Dewhurst, says it's a miracle he's still in business.
So if I didn't have a plan B, that would have been it for me.
Dewhurst was forced to shut down in mid-March because of the pandemic. Government restrictions kept the store closed for 3 months. So for Dewhurst, plan B meant seeing a few of his best customers in secret.
I had to break the law. I had to make sure that I brought in a couple of people to keep my head above water, and I'm sure a lot of other people did that also, you know, based on the fact that, you know, this is what we had to do.
Thousands of small businesses have struggled to stay afloat through pandemic shutdowns, but in Canada, Black-owned businesses have been especially hard hit. A recent survey found that, like Dewhurst, Black entrepreneurs were already in a more precarious financial position than other small business owners. Dewhurst had less than $5,000 saved up. He's been in business for 17 years, but as a sole proprietor, he's never been able to get a bank loan.
You got numb to the fact, right? You apply and you don't get it, you know, hey. They don't look at me. And this is what we experience in the Black community also. I'm not the only one. I know a lot of other businesses that go through the same exact thing.
Dewhurst says he can't prove he's a victim of racism. And there's no Canadian data that measures whether Canadian banks are less likely to lend to Black entrepreneurs. But Mohamed Elmi, the director of research at Ryerson University's Diversity Institute, says it's clear Black entrepreneurs do face systemic discrimination.
Because of the businesses that they're in and the types of businesses they're in, they're often more likely to be viewed as more risky.
Elmi says nearly half of Black business people in Toronto are self-employed. They most likely provide professional services or work in arts and entertainment. A majority are recent immigrants and might not have strong business networks in Canada or the business training they need to get ahead. Trudeau's plan promises to remedy that.
With this new fund, Black businesses will be eligible for loans of up to $250,000.
This is a game-changing situation. Now I have an opportunity to get a loan.
Small business owner Garcia Hansen-Francis says Trudeau's announcement gave her a new sense of hope.
And especially being a young Black female, this is something that will help me, help the company, and help the community.
Hansen Francis works out of her home and provides remote payroll services to small and medium-sized businesses. She set out on her own 5 years ago, with 15 years under her belt, working for a large company. But she's had trouble expanding the business.
I think I'm at a point where I could excel a lot more.
To move to the next level, Hansen Francis says she needs to borrow money for things like office space, marketing, and professional development. She's kept her full-time job, which brings in a healthy salary, but she still can't get a business loan.
I've had conversation with bank managers where it's, I'm sorry, the bank just won't allow us to do this. the bank won't allow you to do this, but why are you doing it for other, you know, for example, why are you doing it for other Caucasian male business owners?
Hanson Francis finally gave up asking and maxed out her credit cards to cover business expenses. She's hoping that if she qualifies for the new government program, she can pay those off and start to grow. Back at the Supernatural Salon and Spa, Kurt Dewhurst is less optimistic. He'd also like to expand his business, and he'd need to borrow money to do that. But he's heard a lot of broken promises from the government. He's not convinced this time will be any different.
It sounds great. When is it going to be implemented, right? Is it going to be pushed back like everything else that was pushed back? When do we apply? Who applies? You know, does credit status have to do with any application? Does size of business have to do with any application? Does bankruptcies have to do with any application? We need to know the facts.
So far, those details haven't been released. The government says it's still working on them. For The World, I'm Anita Elash, Toronto.
You can find pretty much anything in New York City, even during a pandemic. You just have to know where to look. The World's Bianca Hillier has our story.
Puerto Rican megastar Bad Bunny surprised New Yorkers with a live show. He stood on top of a flatbed truck while rolling through city streets. The truck was decorated to look like a subway car, and the Latin Grammy-winning artist was literally dodging traffic lights and trees mid-song. But dressed in a black, floor-length trench coat and his trademark tiny glasses, Bad Bunny flawlessly performed for almost 2 hours. The tour started in the Bronx at Yankee Stadium before heading south into Manhattan. Onlookers couldn't believe their eyes.
It's just like an I Love New York promo.
That's Bad Bunny.
Is it?
Yeah.
A free concert is one thing, but here was a global pop star right outside people's doorsteps.
Oh my god, yeah, that's Bad Bunny!
The mobile stage was quickly surrounded by fans. Quite a Beatles-esque moment with people running and biking alongside the truck. It all took 15-year-old Christian Bustos by surprise. He was having dinner at a restaurant when...
he just showed up, and we were like, oh my goodness, this is Bad Bunny. Everybody in the restaurant was running over, and we all chased him down. That was one of the coolest moments of my entire life.
Damn, you don't really want him out, bro.
It's a performance that 23-year-old Ramon Bayo wasn't going to miss.
It was essentially like a mosh pit of cars.
Bayo followed the parade to its finale right in front of the Harlem Hospital because the concert wasn't meant to solely entertain. Bad Bunny gave meals and a message of gratitude to frontline workers. He also commemorated the third anniversary of Hurricane Maria, which devastated his native Puerto Rico. The singer told the crowd, "I know we're going through very difficult times, but I have hope that people are doing things with their heart, spirit, faith, and hope. We are going to move forward." For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I love a Bad Bunny parade. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.